So the theme of tonight's Dhamma talk is transformation. In a book that I recently read by Jack Kornfield, it's called The Wise Heart, he tells a true story about a remarkable Buddha statue in Thailand. So, this is what it says. In a large temple in the north of Thailand's ancient capital, Sukhothai, there once stood an enormous and ancient clay Buddha statue. Though not the most handsome or refined work in the Thai Buddhist art, it had been cared for over a period of 500 years and became revered for its old age. Violent storms, changes of government, and invading armies had come and gone, but the Buddha had endured. At one point, however, the monks who tended the temple noticed that the statue had begun to crack and would soon be in need of repair and repainting. After a stretch of particularly hot and dry weather, one of the cracks became so wide that a curious monk took his flashlight and peered inside. What shone back at him was a flash of brilliant gold. Inside this plain old statue, the temple residents discovered one of the largest and most luminous gold images of the Buddha ever created in Southeast Asia. Now uncovered, the golden Buddha draws throngs of devoted pilgrims from all over Thailand. And this statue you can see now, it's in a temple called Wat Thammit in Bangkok. I've been there looking at it. It's really, really big. But as high as this room, and solid gold. It's amazing. So it's believed that this statue was covered with this clay and plaster in times of war and conflicts, and to protect it from robbers and looters that would have stolen it and maybe melted it down. So that's why they covered it up and made it into an ugly clay Buddha instead of a bright golden one. And similarly, during our lifetime, we have all experienced threatening and unpleasant situations that has made us protect our sensitive inner nature with a hard outer shell. And sometimes it's good to have this protective shell when you live in the world, but it can also make us repress certain emotions and become more selfish, not so sensitive to other people. So Vipassana meditation or mindfulness can help us to reaccess our full range of humanity and goodness. So with the help of meditation and awareness in the present moment, we can transform ourselves into freer, happier people, just like this Buddha was transformed from this clay shell to this golden bright image. And this practice can also lead to awakening and freedom from mental suffering. So what then is mindfulness if you try to analyze its constituents? One can say that it has four main principles. And in English, you can summarize this model in an abbreviation called RAIN, R-A-I-N, rain, you know, like the one what we had this afternoon. And rain, I think it's quite a good metaphor because it's both life-giving and it puts out fires. So, and that's what meditation can also do. So, the R in rain, it stands for recognizing, receiving, and relaxing. To see and to recognize something that comes into our senses and to recognize it, that it's there in a relaxed way. And the A is accepting, acknowledging, and allowing. To accept and allow that this thing is there. And the I is investigation, interest, intimacy. To investigate this thing closer and with interest, with curiosity. And the N stands for non-identification, non-struggle with it. So if you don't identify with what you see and always take it personally and get all upset about it, that's then that creates problem. If you non-identify, there is no problem with what comes up. So I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about these different parts of mindfulness. So this first one, recognition. When you first start meditating, you can get a little shocked over what you experience. You may have heard that meditation is supposed to be very peaceful and relaxing and nice in any ways. But what's happening really for at least for most of us, the thoughts rush here and there and the body becomes restless and begins to hurt. You get sleepy or you get annoyed by all the disturbances. That peace that you expected to find doesn't come. And you either think that it's something wrong with yourself or that it's something wrong with the meditation. It's the wrong kind of meditation. Because often we have these preconceived ideas about different things, not just meditation, but how our whole life should be, actually. We would rather just have pleasant experiences, and consequently we always try to avoid things that are unpleasant and difficult. It's a very well rehearsed and habitual way of responding this way. That's how all people respond. And so, of course, we try to apply this to meditation as well. But life consists of constant shifts between what we want and what we don't want, the pleasant and the unpleasant. And that's a fact that we must understand and recognize. So the first principle in Vipassana meditation is this recognition to see what really happens here and now in the body and mind. If it's a nice feeling of some kind, okay, a nice feeling feels like this. Or if it's a restlessness, okay, restlessness feels like this. If there are many thoughts are like this. Or if my knees hurt, okay, hurting knees feels like this. Nothing is wrong, everything can be observed. So that's the recognition part. Then we come to the acceptance and non-judgment part, which is the second principle. And it's very important because even if we see and recognize what is happening, we might still have a resistance to it, to the experience. We don't want to feel it really. We wish that it was different. But accepting doesn't mean that we can't improve things. It just means that right now, in this moment, it is like this. There's a Zen Buddhist saying that says, if you accept, things are just the way they are. If you don't accept, things are still just the way they are. So what we actually add is this resistance to things being what they actually are. We don't like to see things clearly. But acceptance is, we can also notice and accept that we dislike certain things. Acceptance doesn't mean passivity or that you have to like everything. It rather means the courage to stay with whatever is happening without judging and condemning it. And this is a very important step in this transformation process that we have started here. Because transformation is only possible if we can be totally honest with ourselves. Because sometimes we even lie to ourselves. We don't want to recognize and accept what's going on. But that's one of the things we have to do. So the third principle is investigation. So after we have seen, recognized, and accepted our experiences, we have to continue to investigate them really carefully. Many years ago, this was, I did a 2-month retreat in Burma with a teacher called Sayadaw Upandita, and he was known to be quite stern but this investigation was what he was mostly interested in. When you're at a monastery in this tradition, the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, you have to report your meditation experiences in a special formal way. And so first you have to talk about what your experience was, and then what happened to the experience over time. So for example, you could say, when you came into the teacher, I noticed pain in the right knee. When I observed the pain, it increased and it felt like the whole knee was burning. The heat became more intense and concentrated in one single point. And then I straightened the leg and noted the movement. So you see there, that's a way of describing in detail what one saw, and then the whole process that the object went through while I was observing it. And doing this, meditating in this way, which there, since you had to report in this way, you were sort of forced to meditate in this way too. And that really can lead to very good concentration and to the insights into the real nature of phenomena. You can see how everything is changing all the time, how it goes, comes and goes, without an invitation and without an owner. You don't own the things that come. It's just a process going on. So when investigating these meditation experiences, you focus on four areas. I mentioned this the first night, that it's a discourse by the Buddha called Satipatthana Sutta that describes this form of meditation, and it's called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And the word sati in Satipatthana means mindfulness. So these four areas are the body, which we have been talking about already quite a lot. And then it's something called feeling tone, vedana. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. And then it's the mind, which is very important. And then it's another thing called dhamma. But in order to explain all these in detail, I would need many Dhamma talks. Joseph Goldstein explained this sutta in 46 Dhamma talks. And I've done a series of 12 Dhamma talks. So you see, I can only mention a little bit about them in one Dhamma talk. And so then I will just talk about the most important ones that we come across on this retreat, and that's the body and the mind, really. And about the body, I've talked quite a lot already, so I'll be a bit brief about that too. So observing the body, as I told you, means that we're, first of all, aware of the breath. That's our anchor, and that's what keeps us alive. You know, keep in mind that it's only you're only one breath away from death. If the next breath doesn't come in, you will die quite soon. And so that's why we should observe every breath with the same interest as if it was the last one. That's quite a heavy thing, but actually that's, you can never know what happens in the next moment. And as I said before too, that different teachers prefer different places to observe the breathing, and the nostrils, upper lip, or the abdomen, belly area, that's the most common places. And that's why I keep it a bit open, so if you already have a practice, so then you can just continue with that. Or if you're new to this technique, you can test which one is easiest for you. For me, I think the abdomen is the easiest. And now when we do Qigong also, that sort of corresponds to the Tan Tien, when we do Qigong and also in Tai Chi. So that's why I think that's the simplest and most grounding as well. Sort of it's in the middle of the body, and it feels more grounding than being up here in the head. But you can experiment with that. And in the body, we also observe all the other sense impressions. I've talked about sounds, for example, but also sights, touches, tastes, and smells. And when we sit and meditate with our eyes closed, it's mostly hearing and touching that are the predominant senses. But sometimes we can also have inner visions. We can see pictures inside our mind. And there also sometimes some passing fragrance can pass by. When we do walking meditation, which is also part of the body section, then all the senses are more in, we use more all the senses, and then we can broaden our awareness to all the senses. All kinds of sounds are really excellent meditation subjects, both as a body thing and a mind thing, because we tend to enjoy some sounds more than others. Like a bird song, for example, is we think most people think is a nice sound, but if there's an airplane or something, some mechanical sound, that can be disturbing or annoying. And so that's quite interesting to observe this very instinctive opinions we have about different sounds, because actually all sounds are just vibrations in the air that hits your eardrum, and then the brain somehow interprets this to sound, but they evoke completely different reactions in the mind. And touching, that's all the sensations that occur when the body comes in contact with something else, you know, when we sit in contact with a cushion or a chair or the hands or lips or the touch points. I've talked about that before. And you can also, it says in the in this discourse that you can observe all body positions, standing, walking, sitting, lying down, and the states in between, you know, when you're just about to get up or sit down or lie down. And pain, I talked a bit about that too. That's something that very often comes when we sit still for a while, because the body is used to moving. Even when we sleep, we move to avoid pain that comes up. So, but the fact that it might hurt to meditate is something that we usually don't mention very often. We don't talk about it in advance anyway, because then nobody would come to the retreat. If you advertise, come and feel your knees hurt. Wouldn't be enticing. But actually, this that we experience pain more, that's sort of more obvious when we meditate. That's just because we are more, we observe it more, you know. We're more aware of the body than we usually are. For example, if you go to a really interesting movie, you can sit still for an hour easily without moving, because you're so absorbed into this very interesting story and what's happening there on the screen. And then maybe after an hour or so, some discomfort comes, and then you just move without being aware of it. But here you're all the time aware of the body, so every little pain that you probably wouldn't notice otherwise, you can feel. But eventually, with more practice and when you get better concentration, you can sit for quite some time without pain. But it does, it never completely disappears. As long as you're born in a human body, you will always have pain somewhere sooner or later. It's nothing that you can't really escape. And pain has a good side as well. It's very easy to observe. The mind very easily goes there. And so that it's a good way to develop concentration. But as I said before, you shouldn't, strain yourself if it gets too unbearable. Of course, you change position. And in this retreat with the Qigong exercises, I think most people find that they have less pain than usual, because it makes the energy flow better in the body. So hopefully you won't have that much pain. So we can also observe the mind and the mental states. That's the other big one. which I will introduce as an official meditation subject tomorrow morning. But then it's good to know a little bit about it before. So it's all these different emotions and thoughts, ideas, dreams, plans, memories, whatever, that is constantly emerging in the mind. And one of the most common misunderstandings about meditation is that it should be a state without thoughts. I mean, you must have already noticed that's not the case. And it can be actually in some states of very deep concentrations, the thoughts stop for a while. But normally, to achieve a thoughtless state is definitely not the goal of this kind of meditation anyway. Because the mental mind, it's made for thinking. And it has had this habit for your whole life to comment and evaluate everything that comes through the senses, sights, sounds, smells, touches, and taste. And the problem is that for most time in daily life, we're unaware that we think all the time. Because we're so absorbed into the thinking, the thought world, that we don't really know that we're thinking. It's sort of just a natural state. And then when we sit down and meditate and we try to make the mind stay put and observing something quite boring as the breath, the breathing, then we notice that it doesn't want to do that. It doesn't want to obey. It wants to continue to jump around from one association to another, as it has been used to do. And so that's one of the very first insights of this kind of meditation, is that we have very limited control over our own mind. And this is why we have to practice. If we had control of our minds, we didn't have to practice. And that's why we keep bringing the mind back to the breathing or to some other meditation object. And we will have to do this maneuver many, many times during a single sitting and during a whole day. And the more often, the better, actually, because it means that we're lost in thought for a shorter time when we bring the mind back. And the thoughts will continue to come, but we can become aware of them faster. And that so that means that we have gained some concentration. And sometimes, at first, when we start meditating, it seems like the thoughts are much stronger and more of them than usual. But that is mostly because we haven't noticed them before. We haven't been this carefully noticing them, observing them. So that's why they seem to be stronger and multiply, but actually it's not like that. It's just because we see it. So if one accepts thoughts as a natural part of this process and just lets go of them as soon as you become aware of them, without being annoyed, sad, or, you know, condemning, then after a while the mind will calm down. And you will find a sort of rhythm in your meditation practice. And most of the time, you don't have to worry about the content of the thoughts, the stories they tell, because it's usually unimportant comments or associations that pass by, or repetitious thoughts can be very repetitious, which is something that you notice, that it, for some reason the mind likes to think the same thought over and over again. And some thoughts are just nonsense. As soon as you come back to the breath, you have no idea what you were thinking about. So, it's about thoughts. I think it's actually very interesting that the actual fact that the mind can be turned inward and observe itself. And this is in the Western society, in the Western culture, we are not taught to do that. For me anyway, it was quite a revelation, because we're always taught to turn the mind outwards, to observe things outside ourselves. The way science works is also that you observe things outside yourself in microscopes or whatever experiments scientists do. But the Buddha did the opposite thing. He explored the world inside himself. He turned the mind inside. And we can do that too, which is very interesting, I think. And about the thoughts, by the way, sometimes we believe much too much in what we think. The thoughts paint this picture or tells this story. Very often it's some disaster scenario or some other story about ourselves or about others. And we suddenly believe that it's real and true. We can sort of convince, the thoughts can convince ourselves that it's true. And if we really observe, very often it isn't. It's just made up. It's just a hallucination or whatever you can call it. Another of these preconceived ideas that we can have about meditation is that only beautiful and good emotions, such as peace, calm, love, happiness, should arise. But unfortunately, reality isn't quite that nice, you know. You probably already noticed that meditation has sometimes received two good reviews. It can be very frustrating to come to a retreat. I mean, retreat, it sounds like it should be very peaceful, but it can be frustrating to be suddenly thrown into this unusual situation of just sitting and walking, not doing anything particular, sitting, walking, eating, sleeping in silence the whole day. And so, since this is very unusual for us to do, you can almost expect that some unwelcome and quite unpleasant mind states will also appear. And there are especially five different kinds of unpleasant emotional states that usually appear when meditating. And they appear in a list. The Buddha taught a lot. He sort of was very practical. So to make it easy to understand, he made lists of things. And this list is called, usually called, the five hindrances. But actually they're not hindrances in the sense that it stops us. It's more something that can, that, yeah, you can call them challenges rather, because they challenge your investigation of the mind. And these five states are desire, aversion, tiredness, restlessness, and doubt. and also and that sort of groups. There are other desire can be wanting, longing, holding on. Sort of a whole group of different emotions that belong to the desire group. Same with aversion, can be the small irritation or hate, or you know anything in between there. And tiredness can also be sleepiness, or laziness, unwillingness, resistance. And restlessness can also be worry about something, thinking of making these disaster scenarios in the mind and worrying about things. And doubt, well, doubt is doubt, actually. That's in the aversion group, you can also have fear that belongs to that. All the things that you want to push away belong to the aversion group, and all the things that you want to have belongs to the desire group. And we can learn to recognize these states and know that it's one of the hindrances. Because otherwise, very often we think it's something wrong with ourselves. We think we're the only one that has this difficult mind states. Everybody else is sitting around looking like little Buddhas. And we have all this aversion or sleepiness or whatever it is. But, so it's very good to know that this is universal states that meditators from the time of the Buddha has encountered in their practice. Then it's much easier not to take them personally. Sometimes there can be several hindrances at the same time. You know, you can have maybe restlessness, which gives rise to aversion, and which gives rise to doubt. Is this really what I should do? Well, this is called a multi-hindrance attack. I'm sure you maybe had one of those sometime. So one emotion that comes is desire or longing for something. And it can be anything depending on your own temperament and life situation. For some people it's food or sensual pleasures of some kind. For others, they long to read something or listen to music or some other amusement. That's one phenomena I've noticed on, I've done some long retreats, 3 months and more, without reading anything, and I like to read. So then sometimes just has this urge to read. So if you're in the bathroom and there is some detergent or something, ooh, how interesting it is to read on this package, what it contains and everything. So it can be really a desire for something to divert the mind, you know. It's really funny. And the opposite of desire is, of course, aversion and anger. And it can be caused by some memory that comes up, or that you feel annoyed by someone here on the retreat, that you don't think that they behave the way they should. But just try to observe your own reactions to whatever comes up, and never talk to any other participant about if you think that something is wrong. Talk to us, to the teachers or the manager, and then we can maybe see what's going on. So that's desire and longing and aversion and tiredness. As many of you have already noticed, the first days of a retreat, usually almost everyone at one point or another do the nodding meditation. And it's not that pleasant, but it's also totally natural. Because sometimes in the busy daily life that we have, we don't get enough sleep. We stay up too late and then we have to get up to work or something. And so there can be sort of tiredness that now when we suddenly have nothing else to do, nothing to divert ourselves, no activities to go to, then this old tiredness comes up, but usually it only lasts at the most 3 days, and it's usually not in every sitting. And what you can do about it is standing up. If you're in the meditation hall and you just keep nodding and you don't like it, it feels unpleasant, then standing up is the best medicine. And it's okay to do that. Because the body has this self-preservation, that it doesn't want to fall over and fall on the floor. So then it sort of wakes up. So that's, if you're not in the meditation hall, there are other little things you can do, like wash your face with cold water or go outside. And also one thing they recommend is to look at something bright, a lamp or the sky or something that sort of also makes you feel a bit, wakes you up a bit. And the opposite of this sleepiness is restlessness and worry. And that too might be very interesting to just sit still, very, very still, and feel how it feels to be restless and maybe bored even. Because usually in daily life, if we're bored or restless, we immediately do something. Because we have the opportunity to turn on the television or go to the refrigerator and see if there is anything good there to eat. Or, you know, read something or whatever. We always divert ourselves. So we never really experience boredom and restlessness and see what it really is. So it's really... can be really interesting to just sit there and not trying to escape it, to just feel what it feels like. And usually it goes away when you don't act on it. But there's nothing to count on. But not trying to escape from restlessness can really give some insights into the workings of the mind. And this fifth troublesome state that can come up is doubt. Questions may come up. What am I doing here? I can't handle this. Is this really meditation, by the way? Should it be this hard to meditate? Perhaps some other kind of meditation is better for me, or, you know, all these kind of things. And doubt is a very good and relevant feeling. It means that we're not, you know, fooled by things, that we don't, take everything for granted. The Buddha himself said in one of his discourses that you shouldn't believe in anything until you've tested it and seen that it's good for yourself and others. So, if you have doubt, it can easily lead to that you don't give things a chance, you know, you just sit and think and compare with this and that, and should I do this or should I do that, and maybe this is a little better, you know. And so on retreat, it's best if you just tell your own mind that, okay, I see you, doubt, I see that you're here, and I recognize that doubt is a relevant feeling, but now I'm here, and I paid money to be here, and now, so why don't you wait until the last day of the retreat when I come home, then I can see if this doubt is relevant or not, and now I just try this technique, this meditation out. That's the best way to work with doubt when you're in retreat. Don't waste your time, because this is very precious time. Not very many people in the world have this opportunity to actually come to a place like this, where we're taken care of, given food, and just have the time to look into our own minds and bodies. It's very fortunate time, so don't waste it. It seems like this talk is a bit longer than it should be. So I'm just gonna, this was all about investigation, how what we investigate in meditation. So we've gone through recognition, acceptance, and investigation, and now I'm just going to mention a little bit about the last bit of RAIN, the N, non-identification. And this means that we try not to see our experiences as I, me, and mine. In general, as soon as an emotion arises in the mind, for example, we get angry with someone that's pushing ahead in the queue or something like that, and then you immediately identify with this feeling, I'm angry with this idiot. And at the worst, if you're not aware of this, you can even start some action, pushing this person away, or, you know, whatever. So that's how we very often even if we don't go into action, we own this anger or whatever feeling it might be. But now, in this, when you do it in meditative way, you just consider how anger feels. You investigate its effect on the mind and body, and you don't see it as your own. You just feel whatever sensations there are, you know, whatever you feel, and like I was saying, does it get stronger or weaker, or what happens to it? And in that way, you can avoid owning this emotion. See it as part of the ever-changing process of life instead. So, when we observe our body and mind with this mindfulness, acceptance, and non-identification, we can develop a much freer approach to ourselves and to our history. Certain psychological patterns can become clear to us, and when we see them, we can also start freeing ourselves from things we no longer need. we can start transforming our minds to let go of all these unwholesome states of mind, like anger and anxiety and fear. And we can try to develop wholesome states like joy, calm and concentration. And we can also see one thing that's very interesting, that the mind, the part of the mind that observes the mind, mind observes itself, but the part, the observing part of the mind, the actual awareness, that's a neutral function. It's very obvious that nobody owns it. It's just a neutral function in the mind. And when we can rest in this and just observe the passing show of thoughts, feelings, sensations, then the mind becomes very calm and concentrated. And that leads to joy and equanimity, and eventually maybe to enlightenment, to Nibbana, which is freedom from mental suffering. So I want to end with a short poem. It's called Unconditional by a poet called Jennifer Wellwood. Willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within me. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who made it so, who crafted this master game. To play it is pure delight, to honor its form, its true devotion. So let's sit just a minute.